Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome to the Dogs Program. We are the Dogs, the Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools, and we are here every Saturday to defend and promote public education. I'm Dale, and I'll be your host today while Jean is at uni, but we have a full program for you, so let's jump right in. First off, I'll pass you over to Andy, who has some information on what's happening in Victorian public schools. Over to you, Andy.
Thanks. Allan Government's classroom device plans laughable, while public schools are lowest funded. The Australian Education Union Victorian branch says expecting the lowest funded public schools in the country to provide students with laptops and tablet devices is laughable. Today, the Education Minister announced that from 2027, public primary schools will be required to provide electronic devices from existing supplies and budgets. Not requiring parents to pay for tablets or laptops is a good thing. They should never have had to in the first place. But the Allan government is living in a dreamland if they think public schools have the budgets available to provide devices to all students when Victorian public schools are the lowest funded in the nation, President Justin Mullaly said. Instead of delivering the funding, Premier Allan has cut $2.4 billion from public schools through to 2031. This is a disgrace and makes the claim that Victoria is the education state meaningless nonsense. There is no way that Victoria's public primary schools will be able to ensure students have access to up-to-date technology and secure devices unless the Premier stops the con job and fixes her public school funding mess. Indeed. Back to you.
Thanks for that. Yeah, it is quite difficult to imagine how inappropriate such an idea would be, especially when you're talking about public schools, which are the least funded schools in Australia. There's very few public schools nationwide that actually achieve the SRS, the Schooling Resource Standard. So how are they going to find the resources to have devices such as the Allan government is suggesting? Anyone's guess. Especially when there's no SRS in the near future, as we'll hear more about in this program. Now we'll move over to an interesting report from comparing Australia to the OECD when it comes to teacher shortages. Again, I'll pass you over to Andy.
Australia has amongst the highest teacher shortages in the OECD. And this is an article written by Trevor Cobbold and published in Save Our Schools on October the 21st. A new OECD report reveals that Australia's education system is facing a diabolical staffing crisis. Since 2018, teacher shortages have soared, leaving Australia among the worst performing nations in the OECD on this measure. Despite the scale of the problem, little meaningful action has been taken to reverse the trend. The lack of qualified educators is most acute in public schools, disadvantaged schools, and schools in regional towns. There is also a very large shortage of special education teachers. Among OECD countries, Australia records the largest shortage of staff in disadvantaged and regional town schools and the second largest in public schools. The increased shortage of teachers represents a damning failure by governments to ensure that all public schools have a full contingent of qualified teachers. The increased shortage restricts learning in schools, especially in disadvantaged public schools. It is a major obstacle to reducing the large achievement gaps between rich and poor. The continuing shortage also threatens failure to reach even the weak equity targets for 2030 set out in the Better and Fairer Schools Agreement between the Commonwealth and state territory governments. The OECD Teaching and Learning International Survey, TALIS, for 2024, found that 42% of Australian lower secondary teachers are teaching in schools with a shortage of qualified teachers. This is the sixth largest population of 30 OECD countries included in the country. It is almost double the average of 23% reported for 27 OECD countries. The highest shortage is 52% in the Netherlands, and the smallest shortage is 6% in Norway. There was a dramatic increase in shortages since the previous TALIS survey in 2018. The percentage of lower secondary teachers teaching in schools with a shortage of qualified teachers has tripled from 14% in 2018 to 42% in 2024. The increase of 28 percentage points was the second biggest in the OECD, only exceeded by 32 percentage points in the Netherlands. By contrast, several countries managed to reduce their shortage of teachers since 2018. They include France by 16 percentage points, Portugal by 19 points, and Sweden by 7.5 percentage points. There was no statistically significant change in several other OECD countries. The shortage is just as dire for special education teachers. The survey found that 44% of lower secondary teachers are teaching in schools with a shortage of special education teachers. This is the eighth largest shortage in the OECD and much bigger than the average of 33% for 27 OECD countries. The biggest shortage is in the Netherlands, where 53% of teachers were teaching in schools with such a shortage. The smallest percentage is in Poland with 10.5%. The report found that the shortage of lower secondary teachers in public schools in Australia is the second highest in the OECD. It shows that 58% of lower secondary teachers are teaching in public schools with a shortage of qualified teachers. This is virtually equivalent to that of Belgium at 59%, which was the biggest shortage. These shortages are more than double the average of 25% for the OECD. Poland has the smallest shortage, with only 7% of teachers working in public schools with a shortage of teachers. There is a huge gap in the shortage between public and private schools, with only 25% of lower secondary teachers working in private schools with a shortage of teachers. The gap of 33 percentage points between public and private schools is the largest in the OECD. The shortage of teachers in disadvantaged schools in Australia is particularly dire. The survey found that 67% of lower secondary teachers working in disadvantaged schools are in schools with a shortage of qualified teachers. This is the equal highest percentage in the OECD along with New Zealand. It is over double the average for the OECD of 32%. In Lithuania, there is no shortage of teachers in disadvantaged schools. Disadvantaged schools in Australia are almost entirely public schools. The OECD report defines disadvantaged schools as having over 30% of students from socio-economically disadvantaged homes. Research shows that 91% of these schools are public schools. The survey found that 63% of lower secondary teachers are working in regional town schools with a shortage of qualified teachers. This is the largest percentage in the OECD. It is over double the average for the OECD of 25%. Norway has only 4% of teachers working in schools in regional towns with a shortage of teachers. The shortage of teachers in city schools in Australia is the equal sixth largest in the OECD, with 36.6% of lower secondary teachers working in schools with a shortage of qualified teachers. The shortage is much higher than the OECD average of 25%. Cities in Norway have no shortage of teachers. The gap of 26 percentage points in the shortage of teachers between regional and city schools in Australia is the second largest in the OECD behind New Zealand. The average gap across OECD countries is only 0.5 of a percentage point. It should be noted that TALIS is about lower secondary teachers and does not include information about other teachers. Some of the figures look different if we had separate data about primary school teachers or those teaching in senior high schools. Consequently, these findings are an incomplete picture of the state of all teachers. The OECD report does not canvass the causes of shortages of teachers, but there is extensive research evidence showing that the main causes are low salaries relative to other professions, high workload, highly stressful working conditions, and low professional status. For example, a recent international report published by Universities 21, an international network of leading research universities, found that shortages are being driven by low pay, excessive workloads, and a lack of professional recognition. A recent study published by Monash University highlighted lack of public respect for teachers, high workloads, and administrative burdens and safety issues in schools. After the long neglect of the teacher shortage by successive coalition governments, education ministers agreed to a National Teacher Workforce Action Plan, NTWAP, in December 2022 to reduce the shortage. The plan nominates five priorities: increasing teacher supply, strengthening teacher education, retaining teachers, elevating the profession, and better understanding future teacher workforce issues. The plan was heavily criticised for ignoring the root cause of the problem. Internationally renowned educator Professor Pasi Sahlberg of the University of Melbourne said that the crisis was not a shortage of teachers issue, but the lack of adequate compensation and support for existing teachers. An academic assessment of teacher workforce policy in Australia criticised it for concentrating on teacher recruitment instead of teachers' work and the status of the profession, as well as ignoring priority areas such as hard-to-staff schools, is also noted. There are remarkable absences in the list of priority areas of the NTWAP. None directly address the causes of the teacher shortage as revealed by the research studies cited above and teacher surveys, namely low pay, high workloads, too much administrative work, lack of support, and safety at work. No priority is given to improving teacher salaries or increasing safety and well-being of teachers. Reducing teacher workload is largely hived off to pilot projects. Progress in attracting more new students in initial teacher education programs and retaining existing teachers in their jobs has been glacial at best. Funding for pilot projects to examine ways of reducing teacher workload is a feature of the priority area on teacher retention. A recent academic paper concluded, policy actions remain in the pilot phase, under development, or only loosely tied to teacher retention. It is puzzling why pilot projects are needed to reduce teacher workload. The administrative load on teachers is a key factor in teacher attrition. It should be a simple matter for education departments to reduce the reporting and accountability demands on teachers. Pilot projects are just a way of kicking the can down the road instead of directly addressing the issue. State and territory governments continue to resist claims by teacher unions for teachers to be paid at comparable rates to other professions. Workload and administrative tasks continue to be a major source of dispute by teachers as governments largely resist providing more administrative support in schools. Action to reduce workload is restricted to a few pilot programs instead of directly addressing the issue. Training and development appear to be limited to online courses, teaching phonics, and classroom management. It can only be concluded that the NTWAP is not a plan to solve the massive teacher shortage in Australia, but a plan to avoid dealing with the root causes of the shortage. It is a classic case of government disingenuousness. Learning in public schools, disadvantaged schools, and regional town schools will continue to be restricted by the lack of teachers. Now, this article has a lot of very informative graphs included in it, so if you want to check those out, you can go to the Save Our Schools website, and the name of the article again, Australia has amongst the highest teacher shortages in the OECD, which, when you think about it, is a disgrace. Back to you.
It's an interesting report indeed to think that Australia is no longer the clever country. And especially last week we were talking about how universities in Australia are slashing so many courses in the humanities, many of which are teaching courses, yet we have among the highest teacher shortages in the OECD. It beggars belief. And speaking of underfunding, I've got another article here from Trevor Cobold, who's been crunching the numbers again and following on in his series, going from state to state, about how the new schools agreements, the funding agreements, are not what they're cracked up to be. So this one's for Tasmania. Schools agreement fails to fully fund Tasmanian public schools. The claims by the federal and Tasmanian education ministers that Tasmanian public schools will be fully funded by 2034 are a blatant lie. The new school funding agreement between the Commonwealth and the Tasmanian government will not set public schools on the path to fully funding, as government media releases say. Despite a substantial and very welcome boost in funding, Tasmanian public schools will remain underfunded in 2034, 23 years after the Gonski report recommended full funding. Public schools will remain massively underfunded in every year until 2034. It is a shameful neglect of the challenges facing public schools and the learning needs of disadvantaged students, the large majority of whom attend public schools. In 2034, Tasmanian public schools will be funded at 97.7% of their schooling resource standard, the SRS, instead of 100%. Public schools will be underfunded by $37 million in 2034. The cumulative underfunding over the 10 years is estimated at $676 million. Public schools also suffered massive losses under the previous Morrison-era agreement. There are several reasons for the continuing underfunding. First, the Commonwealth increase in its share of funding Tasmanian public schools from 20% to 25% is only gradually phased in over 10 years. The Commonwealth share will increase to 22.5% by 2026, but will not exceed 23% until 2032. Second, the allowance for the Tasmanian government to claim capital depreciation, up to 4% of its SRS, will not be removed until 2034. It will be reduced by only 1 percentage point by 2029, with the remaining 3% to be gradually reduced over the last 5 years. Tasmanian public schools will remain defrauded by this Morrison-era accounting trick for another 9 years. The cumulative loss of funds from this accounting trick will amount to $456 million. Third, the government can include non-SRS expenditure as part of its share of funding public schools. The government can now separately claim expenditure on school transport for public school students up to 1.5% of its SRS share for public schools from 2029 to 2034. The agreement admits these are non-standard inclusions. This is a remarkable admission by governments that these allowances defraud public schools of eligible SRS funding. The government can also continue to claim expenditure on two regulatory authorities as part of its share of funding public schools as it did under the previous agreement. Under the new agreement, it can also claim expenditure on two additional authorities. The funding loss for public schools from these non-SRS allowances will increase from $66 million in 2024 to $76 million in 2029, before reducing to $37 million in 2034. The cumulative loss of funding over the 10 years is estimated at $640 million. The Tasmanian agreement discriminates against public schools by allowing the Tasmanian government to claim non-SRS expenditures as part of its share of funding public schools, but not for its share of funding private schools. Private schools are also subject to regulation, and private school students are eligible for school transport subsidies. Discriminatory defrauding of public schools provides another resource advantage for private schools. The agreement must be revised to give public schools a better and fairer deal. The Commonwealth should accelerate the increase in its funding share of the SRS public schools to achieve 25% by 2029. The Tasmanian government should remove the 4% allowance by 2029 and immediately remove the non-SRS expenditure claims as part of public school funding. And that's the end of the article. You know, when one is reminded that the ALP got into government, including a platform on fully funding public schools, one wonders why they haven't gotten rid of the Morrison-era accounting tricks that assure public schools are to continue to be underfunded. Anyway, we've had a lot already, so let's have a quick break. We'll be back with more dogs after this.
Looking for an easy way to keep up with your annual 3CR subscription? You can now set up an annual debit from your bank account or credit card, and once a year your payment will be automatically deducted. You can cancel at any time and you'll get a reminder each year before payment. Be a constant supporter of Melbourne's precious independent community radio station and set up a recurring payment today. Just go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Panoply, Panorama, Panpipe, Pansy, Aha, Pansexual, Knowing No Boundaries of Sex or Gender. Sound interesting? Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan. All those gender questions making you think too hard? Whether it's transgender, bisexual, polyamorous or beyond, we'll throw those questions into the pan and cook up the answers for you. So go on, push that gender envelope, only on 3CR 855am digital and 3cr.org.au.
3CR is radical radio.
Through our on-air content and community structure, we promote real change for workers' rights, gender equality, environmental action, disability justice, and on racism and First Nations sovereignty.
Do you want to be part of real radical change?
We need you to subscribe. It's just $40 concession, $80 waged, $150 for a band or organisation, and $300 solidarity.
Call 03-9419-8377. That's 9419-8377. Or subscribe online at 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Welcome back, listeners. If you've just joined us, this is the DOGS program, the Defence of Government Schools program. And now I'm going to pass you over to Sorrel, who is going to take us over to the land of the Orange Minion. I'll pass you directly on to Sorrel.
This article is entitled Campus Leaders Mobilise to Battle Trump's Anti-Education Compact, Tooth and Nail, and was written by Brad Reed. Workers, students, campus community members across this great country are working together to fight for a higher education system that actually works for all, one that is affordable, strengthens freedom and democracy, and stands up to its public mission. Campus activist groups are banding together to fight against President Donald Trump's proposed compact with universities, in which they would receive priority access to federal funding in exchange for pledging support for aspects of the president's political agenda. The Sunrise Movement on Wednesday said students and workers at the universities who have been invited by the Trump administration to sign the compact have already gathered thousands of petition signatures, urging school administrators to reject it, and they are planning coordinated campus protests in the coming weeks to keep pressure on their schools to resist any effort to infringe upon academic freedom. The proposed deal with the Trump administration requires that universities abolish institutions on campus that purposefully punish, belittle and even spark violence against conservative ideas. Additionally, it would completely overhaul admissions processes so that schools are not allowed to consider factors such as sex, ethnicity, race, nationality, political views, sexual orientation, gender identity, or religious associations. Critics have said agreeing to these terms would essentially end schools' academic freedom. And the Sunrise Movement compiled quotes from both students and professors explaining their opposition to the Trump administration's proposed deal. Kelsey Levine, a student at the University of Virginia, said the school's signature on the agreement would be tantamount to selling out its most vulnerable populations of students: international students, transgender students, and students of color, as well as compromising its foundational principles of independence, truth-seeking, and democracy. Todd Wolfson, president of the American Association of University Professors, described the Trump administration's proposal as a corrupt bribery attempt that would usher in a new draconian era of thought policing in American higher education. cripple our technological innovation capacity, and assault our very democracy. Evan Bowman, Vice Chair of Higher Education Labour United, said that the battle against the Trump administration's effort to infringe upon academic freedom were being waged with an all-hands-on-deck effort. Workers, students, campus community members across this great country are coming together to fight for a higher education system that actually works for all, he said. One that is affordable, strengthens freedoms and democracy, and stands up to its public mission. John Wormer Muller, a professor of politics at Princeton University, wrote in The Guardian on Tuesday that all universities must reject Trump's proposal on the grounds that it is a thinly veiled attack on academic freedom. It is a test case for whether Trumpists can get away with demanding loyalty oaths. It exceeds the president's powers to begin with, and it is bound to achieve the opposite of its stated goal of academic excellence in higher education. Muller also linked the agreement to what he described as Trump's emerging mafia state, in which there is no guarantee that those bending the knee will not be bullied again. The Chronicle of Higher Education reported on Monday that only one institution, the University of Texas at Austin, has so far signaled support for the compact, while others have started to signal their opposition. Dartmouth president Sean Bialik, for instance, said late last week that she was deeply committed to Dartmouth's academic mission and values and will always defend our fierce independence, and vowed that we will never compromise our academic freedom and our ability to govern ourselves. National legal organization Democracy Forward on Wednesday announced it was launching an investigation into the Trump administration's efforts to strong-arm universities into signing the compact, which it described as an effort to stifle free thought on college campuses. To that end, the organization is seeking access to all public records related to the compact, including all records and communications between U.S. Department of Education officials and any representatives of the 9 universities that were invited by the administration to sign. Sky Perryman, president and chief executive of Democracy Forward, said, "Every American should be concerned about these threats to freedom from the Trump administration," adding that the organization would get to the bottom of what is happening to protect people and our democracy. Back over to you.
Thanks for that, Sorrel. Now we're coming back to Australia, and Andy has a press release from the AEU. Over to you, Andy.
Teachers must not be overburdened in anti-bullying response. The federal government's announcement on the 18th of October of a $10 million package to support schools in tackling bullying is an important step forward, but support for teachers must not be overlooked. The suite of anti-bullying measures announced today, including $5 million for new resources for teachers, students and parents, is welcome news. However, the AEU emphasised that without meaningful systemic support for teachers, the broader goals of safer schools cannot be realised. Schools are reporting far higher levels of student mental health, well-being and behavioural issues. Teachers are on the front line when it comes to preventing and responding to bullying, and they must be fully supported by governments in this important work, AEU Federal President Corinna Haythorpe said. Providing materials and resources is important, but without investing in the people who deliver them through professional development and training, staffing, reduced workloads and proper support, the risk is that those resources will not be able to be used effectively in schools. The AEU welcomes the Albanese government's commitment to foster safer classroom environments. All governments must work with teachers and education support staff to ensure they are adequately resourced to respond appropriately to bullying, especially given the increased complexity of online and AI-mediated harassment. This includes ensuring that all schools have a qualified school counsellor to support students and staff, along with allocation of time to address these issues, so that teachers who are already overworked are not expected to take on additional burdens. In addition, proper allocation of funding to public schools more broadly is essential, so that schools are already under resource strain can take on anti-bullying initiatives without undermining core teaching and learning. From our members' experience, many schools are stretched to the limit, Ms. Haythorpe said. Teachers are balancing large class sizes, increased administrative load, behaviour issues and wellbeing demands. Any new anti-bullying initiative must not add to that burden. It must relieve it. The AEU stands ready to work with the federal government, state and territory authorities and communities to roll out this new initiative. But to succeed, this must be backed with full funding and a clear commitment to supporting teachers and education support staff as well as students.
Thank you for that. Yeah, it's frustrating to think that the teachers who are the least resourced are the ones who are most overburdened. Moving on, I'd like to just make a trigger warning, content warning now for this next article. It does mention abuse, and if you're not interested in hearing about that, please join us again in another 6 minutes. But now I'll pass over to Andy.
Boosting equity and safety for Australia's children. And this was published in Pearls and Irritations on October 27 and written by Andrew Scott. In Australia, 37% of students aged between about 5 or 6 and 18 years go to private schools which charge fees. But while those schools are private, they are not run for profit. However, the proportion of babies and 1, 2, 3, 4 and 5-year-olds in long-day childcare centres, which are not just private but explicitly run for profit, is now nearly double that at 73%. Long-time children's educator and carer Lisa Bryant has said, "Keeping children safe is really expensive, but profits depend on keeping things very cheap. The things that keep children safe are having a lot of really experienced and highly qualified staff. Not-for-profit providers have more consistent staffing, maintain proper adult-to-child ratios, reinvest surplus funds back into their services, and are more than twice as likely to exceed required quality standards as those that run for profit. Big for-profit providers spend much less on staffing, have a higher proportion of casual workers, employ less experienced early educators, and keep being given exemptions so they can operate centres without the required number of qualified personnel. Official reports make clear that a highly casualised workforce makes it difficult to attract and retain qualified staff to meet minimum requirements and do robust referee checks. Therefore, these bad workforce practices are risk factors for child safety. And in turn, excessive dominance of childcare by for-profit operators in Australia is now a risk factor for abuse of children. A defining feature of my generation's era has been the revelations of how many adolescents were abused for decades from the 1960s by pedophiles who worked as trusted authority figures in institutions like schools, churches, youth training centres, scouting and sports organisations, which gave them the perfect cover to prey. Yet, after all the changes made to prevent recurrence of that pattern of offending by pedophiles, new dangers have risen in the under-regulated spaces dominated by for-profit companies, which very young children now inhabit. Many of these companies are hiding behind complex business arrangements so they can re-emerge with new identities after committing offences. The two biggest, G8 and Affinity, misled police after the sickening offences published on the 1st of July, while in August we learned that G8 is the most sanctioned childcare provider in Victoria. Pedophiles are a very small proportion of all people, but they will always persist in finding ways to prey upon children. Our responsibility is to prevent them. If we do not, then we will all be complicit in creating another generation of abuse victims. New laws to maybe reactively cut funding in the future to centres or penalise people after they are proven to have committed extreme new breaches of children's safety are not sufficient. To avoid being complicit, all of us who have superannuation should now check and make changes so that none of our personal accounts can gain proceeds from or help prop up dangerous practices of big, excessively profiteering childcare companies like G8 and Affinity. Some educators and carers who worked for these big for-profit companies have left, exhausted and heartbroken, to become courageous whistleblowers and help us gain glimpses into this tragedy. We need to support them. And the overwhelming majority of early childhood educators and carers who are such good, committed people by doing everything we can to get super funds to disinvest from such companies on ethical grounds. Childcare in Australia is not on a slow path to becoming universal. It has been knocked off by an out-of-control express train of excessively profit-driven companies misusing public money. Childcare will never become universal in Australia until that dangerous express train is brought under control. What is needed to make early childhood education and care safe is the same thing that is needed to make it universal, and that is to increase public and other not-for-profit centres. To do this, it is necessary to cap fees and switch from subsidies to parents to direct funding of providers, with all to receive a base level of funding provided they meet stricter quality rules, with extra funds to only go to providers that operate in places of need. Education Minister Jason Clare must now set a timeline to steadily rebalance the sector so public and other not-for-profit providers gain an adequate presence and we can actually get onto a safe pathway to universal childcare. Dr. Andrew Scott is Emeritus Professor of Politics and Policy at Deakin University. This is an edited extract from a speech he gave to the Equity CoLab Fair by Design Summit in Noosa on the 15th of October 2025. The full speech can be downloaded. The views expressed in this article may or may not reflect those of Bells and Irritations. Dr. Andrew Scott is Emeritus Professor of Politics and Policy at Deakin University and the author of five books, including Northern Lights, the positive policy example of Sweden, Finland, Denmark and Norway, and Running on Empty, Modernising the British and Australian Labor Parties, and Fading Loyalties, the Australian Labor Party and the Working Class. His Northern Lights book has just been translated into Japanese. Andrew is also lead editor and contributor to three chapters of another book, The Nordic Edge, Policy Possibilities for Australia. And back to you.
Thank you, Andy. Yeah, safety is a big issue, and it's something that affects not just kids in school, but generations. And it's an interesting point to be made about generations that got used to the idea of abuse being normal, and hopefully we're moving away from those generations. But yeah, we need to actively create a society where abuse is not the norm. All right, we've had some heavy topics. Let's have a quick break. We'll be back with more dogs after this.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Join me at your choir with Ubuntu Voices Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. on 3CR. Ubuntu is a Zulu word meaning I am here because you are. Ubuntu celebrates the positive contribution African Australians make to our communities in music, academia, the arts, and everything in between. Come with me on a journey. Ubuntu Voices every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m.
None of us are free, one of us is chained, none of us are free.
For 3 years, teachers have had their qualifications, their pay, their pensions and their working conditions attacked relentlessly by this government.
I'm the proud product of a government-funded primary school education and of a government-funded secondary school education.
Australia is one of the richest and luckiest countries in the world, and there's no reason whatsoever why we can't have the very best public schools in the world.
It's still not good enough that kids with disability miss out.
Our education is not for profit. Our education is not for profit.
You're listening to The Dogs, the defence of government schools on 3CR.
Welcome back to the Dogs program, the Defence of Government Schools program. And now I'm going to pass you over to Jeff, our international roving reporter. Over to you, Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. The United States is a basket case for public education at the moment. It's being attacked by MAGA Christian fundamentalists and organised billionaires who are seeking to profit from the public purse. We're going to start with an article from the Network for Public Education. This is a brief one. It's just a note, really. Annalise Henshaw wrote this on the 25th of October. Annalise Henshaw: nearly all state funding for Missouri school vouchers used for religious schools. Annalise Henshaw reports to the Missouri Independent that Missouri's voucher program is essentially state-mandated tithing. As taxpayer funds go straight to religious institutions, state funding of private school vouchers is primarily being used for students attending religious institutions, with nearly 98% of funding going towards Catholic, Christian, and Jewish and Islamic schools. This year, the state lawmakers passed a budget that included a request from Governor Mike Kehoe to supply state-run K-12 scholarship programs, MO scholars, with $50 million of general revenue. Previously, the impact to the state's bottom line was indirect, with 100% tax-deductible donations fueling the program. Donations are still part of the MOS scholars' funding, but the state appropriation has more than doubled the number of scholarships available. During the 24-25 school year, MOS scholars awarded $15.2 million in scholarships. In August alone, the State Treasurer's Office received invoices for scholarships totaling $15.6 million, according to the documents obtained by the Independent under Missouri's open records laws. The invoice process is unique to the direct state funding of the program. The non-profits that administer scholarships, called educational assistance organisations, were the sole keepers of scholarship funds. But now the State Treasurer's Office holds scholarship money derived from general revenue in an account previously only used for program marketing and administration. The invoices contained data on which schools MOS scholars students are attending and the scholarship amount. Of the 2,329 scholarships awarded in August, only 59 went to students in non-religious schools. I'm just going to end that here. The full article is available through the Network for Public Education, and I encourage anyone who would like to read it. But the principle is that most of these states who are pushing vouchers are using most of that money to give it to religious schools. Okay, and now we're going to go to an article by, well, to a letter, actually, from Rachel Lazar, who's CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. And it's to Max Wallace, and Max has kindly forwarded this on to us. And she writes to Max: Max, Americans United tallied several wins for church-state separation in the last month, and we're preparing for an even busier, hopefully even more victorious November. In the October wins, a Massachusetts court blocked an attempt by Quincy Mayor Thomas Koch to raise two large statues of Catholic saints at the city's new public safety building. The court's order came in a lawsuit filed by AU and our allies on behalf of the interfaith group of Quincy residents, including Catholics, who don't want their city spending $850,000 on religious statues that violate church-state separation and could even discourage people from seeking emergency services because they fear religious discrimination. Last month, I shared the good news about the resignation of Oklahoma's Superintendent of Public Instruction, Ryan Walters, the Christian nationalist whom AU has sued multiple times for using his government platform to impose Christian nationalism onto Oklahoma public school students in pursuit of his own career ambitions and personal power. I'm happy to share that his replacement, Lyndall Fields, appears to be doing much of Walters' agenda. Listeners, just as an aside, Ryan Walters, the Christian nationalist who's the superintendent of public education in Oklahoma, was also sprung watching porn whilst on a Zoom call with other people in his group of in the education. And he claimed it wasn't, it was an accident, but seems to have undone any appearance of his absolute Christian credentials. But anyway, back on to this. This month, Fields announced that he does not plan to pursue one of Walter's initiatives that is the subject of an AU lawsuit, distributing Bibles and biblical character education materials to public schools. Fields' spokesperson has also indicated he would like to settle the lawsuit AU and allies filed challenging Walter's new social studies standards, which are infused with Christianity. Thanks to our lawsuits, the Oklahoma Supreme Court has blocked Walters from spending public money to buy Bibles and biblical character education materials and from implementing the new social studies standards while our cases are pending. These are hopeful signals, but we were staying in court to ensure that Walters' abuses are fully reversed and do not happen again. And just again, an aside, Walters was trying to use public money to buy Trump Bibles, trying to give himself a national profile at the same time. Anyway, Americans United Against Church and State, she writes, Rachel Lazer, we're not just fighting back these days, we're fighting forward. Another highlight from October was the United States Representatives Yasemin Ansari, Jared Huffman and Jamie Raskin, all members of the Congressional Free Thought Caucus, introducing a resolution honouring the foundation principle of separation of church and state, opposing extreme right-wing Christian nationalism. As I noted for the media, this resolution is a breath of fresh air because our country needs a national commitment, recommitment, to the separation of church and state before it's too late. Our democracy depends upon it. Some wins are harder to see, but we are driving the narrative even at the Supreme Court. According to an exhaustive analysis of the nearly 2,000 amicus briefs to the United States Supreme Court, Americans United's lawyers authored up one of the top 10 most influential briefs because it contributed 3.6% of its unique language to the Muhammad versus Taylor opinion. AU staff is preparing a flurry of activity in early November. There will be a critical federal court hearing in our latest lawsuit to force Texas school districts to remove Ten Commandments displays. Americans United is also co-sponsoring several events. AU Senior Litigation Counsel Amy Tye and I will speak in Dallas on November 5th about Christian nationalism in Texas. The Courier Texas Newsroom is co-sponsoring these panel discussions, and they offers people to join them. If you're in Washington, D.C. on November 7th, come and see Americans United staff at the Crooked Media Networks Conference, Crooked Con. AU is an event sponsor, and we're hosting the lounge at Crooked Con, where you can learn about Americans United's recent legal cases and policy efforts while recharging your phone and yourself. I think our founders would be proud of how much Americans United is getting done in an exceptionally important moment for our mission, and they would be delighted to know that we have such a committed, informed and generous group of supporters that fuel our work. You, we're so grateful. And that's with hope and determination, she writes, Rachel Lazer, President and CEO. So the Americans United for Separation of Church and State have had some successes lately, at least in the lower courts and up to the appellate level. In maintaining the constitutional provisions of the First Amendment, which include the Establishment Clause in the American Constitution, which separates the church from state and protects people from religious favoritism, essentially in a secular democracy, something which was incorporated into our Constitution, Section 116 of the Australian Constitution, which similarly is an establishment clause, but which was overturned when the Dogs took them to court in the 1970s and 80s to prevent government funding of religious schools. The Dogs lost that case, and the fight continues to make, because it is still relevant and there's nowhere on the planet more important right now to understand the differences that the importance of such a clause right now is the United States and the terrible destruction of public education that's occurring there. With that, I'm going to pass you back to the headquarters of the Dogs. Cheerio.
Strange days indeed. Thank you, Jeff. Well, now we get to the best part of our program, the Great State School of the Week.
Every week on the Dogs program, we have a special segment to show a different state school is a great school.
State schools are great schools.
School of the week.
State school.
School of the week.
Great state schools.
State schools.
School of the week.
School for the week here on the Dogs program.
This week's Great State School of the Week is Glenroy College. Now, a little bit from their website. Glenroy College is a co-educational Year 7 to 12 school in Melbourne's northern suburbs, about 13 kilometres from the CBD. Our students are drawn from the nearby communities of Glenroy, Coburg, Oak Park, Hadfield and Pasco Vale. We value the diversity within our school community and believe all our students can achieve a high standard. The college has just undergone a multi-million dollar redevelopment, with spacious state-of-the-art learning and administration spaces added for staff and students. The $9 million additions to our college include a new library and resource centre, dedicated junior and senior school wings, specialist arts and technology spaces, and new administration buildings. The college also has a well-appointed gymnasium, performing arts centre, science centre and undercover canteen. A series of green passive recreational outdoor spaces for students was also revealed when the development was officially unveiled in 2021. A smaller enrolment of 500 students allows the college to foster a strong pastoral connection with every student, while maintaining a mean class size of 21 to maximise academic output. There is a strong focus on attendance and effort in class. Roles are marked every lesson and parents are contacted when students are absent. Developing a strong home-school partnership is considered crucial, and teachers report to parents through progress reports, reporting nights, and individual interviews. Curriculum at Glenroy College is designed to cater for different stages of learning. Student voice and student leadership provide genuine input to the college programs and structure. Our clear focus is to provide students with a viable pathway, including both academic and vocational opportunities. Specialised literacy and numeracy programs and assistance support our drive to continually improve literacy and numeracy across the college. Our teachers are committed to professional learning to achieve these goals. Years 7 to 10 are guided by the Victorian curriculum with a rigorous testing regimen to inform teacher planning and student goal setting. Year 10 also provides alternative academic and vocational pathways linked with work placement and access to VCE subjects for capable students. Year 11 and 12 formalise pathways through VCE and VCAL. Our school values of achievement, respect, integrity and teamwork drive everything we do at Glenroy College. We collectively strive to provide the highest standards of care and learning to our students so that our local community can consider Glenroy College an excellent choice for its students. A steady increase in enrolment, reputation and results over recent years supports our continued push for excellence in education. And now some facts and figures from the My School website. The enrolment is 438 and the ICSEA value is well below average at 918. It's representative of a very diverse urban community. Only 3% of parents come from the upper quartile of parental income, and the second level of parental income is 11% of students. The third quartile, that is below 50%, lower middle class, that would be called, I guess, 20% of students come from there, and 67% of students come from the lowest income quartile, with 77% speaking a language other than English at home and 1% Indigenous students. Their finances. Recurring grants from the Australian government are at $2.18 million. From the Victorian government, $8 million. Private fees at $179,259, and other private contributions are at $156,963. So that comes to, per pupil, $24,534. And capital grants were $1.4 million over 3 years. And their NAPLAN results are creditable. So congratulations to Glenroy College. You are our great state school of the week. Congratulations to Glenroy College and to all of the school and the school community making that such a great school. Well, we've run out of time for today, but if you'd like to find out more about us, you can go to our website at www.adogs.info. That's www.adogs.info. But from all of us here at the Dogs on 3CR, it's bye for now.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au and thanks for your support.